Hi, the following is a conversation with the Lord Professor Martin Rees, a leading cosmologist and astrophysicist. He has conducted influential work on galaxy formation, cosmic jets, black holes, gamma ray bursts, and speculative aspects of cosmology. Professor Rees is the Astronomer Royal and the past president of the Royal Society. He is a prominent scientific spokesperson and author of popular science books. In 2012, he co-founded the Center for the Study of Existential Risk, which is a research center at the University of Cambridge intended to study possible extinction-level threats posed by present and future technology. In this podcast, we cover some of the aspects illustrated by Professor Rees in his book on the future, and these include nuclear warfare, climate change, biotech, pandemics, and artificial intelligence. Due to these challenges, Professor Rees believes that we will face a growing tension between three things we want to preserve: privacy, security, and freedom. I know this is a polarizing topic, and please consider that this is not a debate, but it's an opportunity to hear what one of the most prominent scientists and policymakers has to say about global threats, including the current situation. So, whether you agree or disagree, please leave a comment below. And now, here's my conversation with Professor Martin Rees. Okay, good morning, Professor Martin Rees.
Good morning.
So, I'd like to start our discussion with maybe if we could discuss a bit about what was your major scientific contribution, and if you had to pick up a paper among your 500 plus publications, which one would you choose?
Well, I find it difficult. I'd like to say really that my contribution has been to be involved in various debates over the last 40 or more years, which have clarified how our universe began and also clarified the nature of some of the extreme objects in it. The objects that involve neutron stars, black holes, cosmic explosions, etc. So I've written a lot on all those themes.
I was checking some projects online, and I found this illustrious TNG project, which is a fascinating attempt to simulate galaxy formation and evolution. And these simulations basically start from collections of particles and the laws of physics, such as gravitational interactions and the magneto-hydrodynamical interactions. So my question is, I don't know if this makes sense, but what would it take to simulate the emergence of the laws of physics from the Big Bang?
Well, we don't understand how the basic laws originate, but we know that the expanding universe is governed by those laws, and we can trace the Big Bang and its history right back to when the universe had been expanding for about a nanosecond. Before a nanosecond, it's hard because the energy of every particle is higher than the energy we can achieve in the Large Hadron Collider, the biggest accelerator. So the physics is not well understood for the first nanosecond. But from that time onwards, we can understand how, as the universe expanded and cooled, the different processes took place. We can understand how helium and deuterium were formed when the universe was a few minutes old. And we can understand how the radiation, the thermal radiation, was produced in the early universe, and it cooled down. And these obey the laws of physics we understand. It's been quite easy to understand how a homogeneous universe, just uniform gas, would behave. But, of course, what we want to do is to understand how structures emerge. And we know that the early universe wasn't completely smooth. There were some places slightly denser than average, some less dense than average. And as the universe expanded, then the overdense regions lagged behind in their expansion and eventually condensed out. And this is how we believe galaxies formed. And what's one of the great triumphs of science in the last 25 years has been to observe the fluctuations in the universe at an early epoch. This is done by looking at the background radiation over the sky and seeing the small non-uniformities, and to put that in as your initial conditions in a computer program and work forward. And the good news is that working forward, you end up with a universe rather like the one we live in. And this is done by putting into the calculation gravity and gas dynamics and maybe some other things. And this has been great progress in the last 20 years because it needs good computer power. And until 20 years ago, it was not possible. And of course, more generally, astronomy has benefited hugely from computer simulations because if you're a particle physicist, you can actually crush particles together and see how they behave, whereas we can't actually crash real galaxies together, but we can, in the virtual world of our computer, see what happens if two galaxies collide or if stars explode, etc. And that's how we have been able to see if our models do represent the real world. And we now have a picture for how galaxies evolve, which comes from simulations, but which is tested. And in fact, we can test it very well because we look at galaxies now, but we have an advantage over paleontologists in that we can actually see the past. So we can compare our simulations with the universe now, the universe a billion years ago, 2 billion years ago, 3 billion years ago, etc., by looking at more and more distant galaxies where the light set out earlier. So we have quite good evidence that we understand the broad outlines of how cosmic structures evolved from the amorphous Big Bang, which started off very hot and dense with small fluctuations in it. But of course, all progress in science leads to new questions and new mysteries. And what we'd like to know is the crucial process which happened right in the very first nanosecond when the physics is uncertain, because it's those processes which determine how the universe expands and the fact that it contains atoms, dark matter, and radiation. And that's still a challenge.
In your books, you spoke about having a sort of a cosmic perspective towards the problems of the world. And you became interested in topics related to existential threats. And you discuss these things in your book on the future. And I've also read your other book, which is Our Final Hour, where you talk about these issues. When did you become interested in these topics?
Well, of course, that's quite separate. There's a huge gulf between the cosmic scale and the terrestrial scale. But I'd always been interested in politics and going back to student demonstrations for disarmament, anti-Vietnam War and things like that when I was a student. And later in my career, I got involved more in disarmament through things like the Pugwash conferences, which are links between scientists in the East and the West during the Cold War. So I got involved in that. But later in life, I had more opportunity and more obligation, in fact, to engage in policy and politics because I spent 5 years as president of our Royal Society, which is the UK's National Academy of Sciences. And that, of course, covers all the sciences and their policy implications. And so during that period, and since then, I've spent a fraction of my time on things which are not astronomy, but more general policy related to what's happening here on Earth now.
You're also the Astronomer Royal. What's the role of the Astronomer Royal?
It's just an old title. It used to be the person who ran the observatory, the National Observatory at Greenwich, near London, but that became a museum when it became possible to build telescopes on higher and drier locations, Hawaii and Canary Islands, etc. But they kept the title, but it's just an honorary title.
You're also the co-founder of the Center for the Study of Existential Risks here in Cambridge. What's the purpose of this center?
Well, this is something which I've become more committed to over the years. In my early book, Final Hour, which you mentioned, I drew attention to the fact that we were in the world becoming vulnerable to new classes of threats that weren't important in the past. And in my new book on the future, I explain this in more detail. And the main points that I make in these books is that this century is special. The Earth's been around for 45 million centuries, but this is the first when one species, the human species, has been numerous enough and empowered enough to actually determine the fate of the planet. We can affect the Earth's climate, flora and fauna on it, and of course we are interconnected through air travel, internet, and all that. And so for the first time, we run a risk of catastrophes which could cascade globally. And this is something which is new. And these are less studied than more local conventional risks. And I wrote quite a bit about that. And our centre in Cambridge has a focus on these extreme high-consequence, low-probability threats, which are becoming more important and looming larger. And, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic that we're having this year has, of course, made people take these seriously, because that in itself shows how some unexpected threat can have global consequences. And we clearly are learning that we need to prepare more to cope with catastrophes of that kind and to minimize the chance that they occur. Pandemics are just one category, but there are other things like a breakdown in the electric power grid in a large region, either accidental or a cyber attack, and other global catastrophes which could come about. And so what our centre is doing is collecting a group of people who will focus on these and draw on the sort of convening power of a great university like Cambridge to bring more expertise to bear on these questions.
I mean, in terms of politics, does it cover the full spectrum of politics? Is it a bipartisan sort of organization?
Well, it's not party politics, but it does include social scientists and economists, of course. That's very important. But of course, we are experts who advise politicians. And of course, we do engage with politicians and participate in parliamentary affairs and try and raise the profile of these issues on the agenda compared to the way they were. So this is something which we think is important, because politicians obviously have a crowded agenda. They tend to focus on the immediate and the local and what happens before the next election. COVID-19 pandemic is a wake-up call, because this is a crisis which they never prepared for properly, and indicates what can happen. What we need to do is to make sure that governments do prioritise these. There's an important maxim which I like to quote is, the unfamiliar is not the same as the improbable. And because these things have never happened before, that doesn't mean they won't happen. A pandemic, in retrospect, wasn't all that improbable. There'd been others a bit like it in the last 20 years. And so we need to prepare more for these things. And of course, there's a class of threats which are caused collectively by our heavy footprint on the planet. And this is, of course, climate change. And we know that is going to have severe consequences. But the political problem of dealing with that and prioritising that is that the main effects are going to be a few decades in the future. They're not immediate. It's not like the COVID-19, which has immediate effects. And so we're rather like the frog in the pot of water that's being heated, which doesn't realise that it's going to boil until it's too late to save itself. And we've got to think further ahead to do this. And of course, the problem for politicians is that they tend to focus on the more immediate concerns and also on the concerns for their constituents. And of course, climate change is going to have a bigger effect in parts of Africa than it does here. And so to get politicians to prioritise what happens in Africa 30 years from now is hard. And the only way this can be done is if the public cares. And so they respond to public pressure. So that's why raising the agenda on these long-term issues among the wider public is very important.
And you guys also collaborate with the SAGE, which is the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies here in the UK.
Not directly. There's some overlap, obviously, but and there is a parliamentary committee at the moment which is going to discuss better ways in which this country can prepare itself for these different kinds of threats. So we are obviously in a university, in all of science, trying to be useful when we can. And clearly, these extreme threats are now being taken more seriously.
Yeah, so when we talk about threats from space, I mean, we have threats from comets, asteroids, solar flares. I mean, for those things, there isn't much we can do at the moment. I mean, maybe in the future we could think about changing the path of a meteor or a comet or whatever. So I guess the only option now is building underground bunkers or Faraday cages. Have you built one under your home?
No, but because asteroid impacts don't keep me awake at night. And the reason for that is that we understand their probability. We understand how many asteroids there are, etc. And we know it's a possibility, but a low probability. And we know that that probability is no higher now than it was 10,000 years ago or 10 million years ago. And so it's small. And indeed, as you say, we might be able to do something to protect against some within this next century. And so it's important to try and map out the orbits of all the asteroids that come near. That's where, but it's not a top priority. What is more worrying are the classes of threats which are getting more probable year by year, like pandemics, cyber attacks and things like that. I worry far more about those and about engineered pandemics and things of that kind. They're the big worry. Solar flares are in a slightly different category because they're natural phenomena, but they had no effect on life on Earth until 150 years ago when we had electricity. But they do, of course, now have a potentially serious effect. And so they are something which we want to predict a bit better by observing the sun carefully, and also, of course, to mitigate the effects of by the way we construct the electricity grid, and also the way we harden the electronics of spacecraft.
And also we have plans in place in case something happens, which is taking all the government or Her Majesty the Queen to the bunkers. They have similar programs in the US where they have these emergency plans, which were from the Cold War, I guess, when there was a threat of nuclear war.
Yes, well, so certainly there have been those threats, but the key question is to decide what is the appropriate response to any kind of catastrophe. Of course, we know the problems of hospitals being overwhelmed by a severe pandemic. We know that if electricity failed for a few days over a large area, that would lead to complete social breakdown, because the lights going out is the least of our problems. All electronics and everything would fail. And so we need to absolutely minimize the likelihood of those things happening and also have emergency plans in operation to deal with them.
Let's talk about artificial intelligence, because, I mean, there are so many people talking about super AI and rogue AI and all these things. And at page 104 of your book, On the Future, you spoke about, you wrote, would a powerful futuristic AI go rogue? And would it learn enough ethics and common sense so that it knew when this should override its other motives? So you talk about ethics. You say that this hypothetical super AI should be equipped with the ethics. But my question is, which ethics? Is it Christian ethics, communist ethics, anarchic ethics, or new atheist ethics?
Well, I mean, I think that is a big challenge for those who control it. I mean, let me say that I worry less than some people about these science fiction scenarios. I think AI has important positives and negatives in the short term. The positives are that it does enable us to control better things like traffic flows in a city or electric power grids, where you have to process information and respond to it very quickly. And indeed, it would be of huge benefit to, say, China, if they wanted to have a planned economy, and they could have a planned economy of a kind that Marx and Stalin could only dream of, because they can now monitor every transaction and the inventory in every shop, etc. So they could use it for that purpose. And also, in the short term, there are concerns about leaving decisions to AI, because the AI learns from a large data set, and it incorporates all the biases that went into that data set. And so I think we should be reluctant to leave a decision on whether we are sent to prison, whether we are recommended for surgery, or indeed whether we have a good credit rating from the bank to a machine. Because even if a machine can be shown to, on average, make better decisions than a human, we feel that we'd like to be able to contest and query a decision if we don't like it and get an answer we can understand. Because there's always an uncertainty about whether there are some bugs in the program which aren't being taken account of. And that's already been found in face recognition techniques. It turns out that you can confuse a AI in face recognition in a very subtle way. And so that's a real danger.
If you wear those masks for...
Even a small change in an image can have a big effect on the response for many of these programs. And so I tend to think that it would be quite a long time before some of these more futuristic things come about. I mean, for instance, even something like fully driverless cars, what's called stage five, where you can sit in the back like having a chauffeur. People used to say that would come within 5 years. I don't think anyone thinks that now. We can have driverless cars in controlled environments, on a grid of city streets, for instance, but not in all weather conditions, all traffic conditions, etc. That's further in the future. And going back to machines learning, the problem is that they can absorb data at a huge rate, but they can really only get a feel for common sense by watching real human beings. And the trouble there is that everything we do is very slow. It's like us watching trees grow. It's very slow and boring. And so the data input which goes into a machine from watching actual human beings doing real things in real environments is too slow to be very effective. And that's why there is a problem in getting machines to have what we would call common sense. And this is a limit to the amount of discretion that we should give them, really. And we should be beware of a situation where the machines are too much in control.
I think we're having also a hard time understanding what common sense is and also what intelligence is. And these are big questions in philosophy.
Of course, yes, yes, yes. And as you say, the ethics is a matter for disputes and is very culture dependent. So that's a very big problem.
I had a discussion with a senior director from DARPA, and at DARPA they work on very advanced technologies, and one of them is artificial intelligence. And recently they came up with a thing called Alpha Dog Fight Trials, where an AI system was basically piloting an F-16 fighter jet, and they managed to beat one of the best pilots in the U.S. And all the media were scared. They said, oh, AI is going to take over. We're going to have the next Terminator and all these things. But I think the lesson there was that AI can be part of the human endeavor in terms of collaboration. So AI can help humans for tasks that are repetitive and boring.
Well, that's right. And can process information much faster and do calculations faster. Those are the advantages. But of course, robots are still clumsy compared to real people. I mean, a machine can beat the world chess champion, but a robot can't move the pieces on a real chessboard as adeptly as a child can. And so there's a long way to go before robots are as good as we are in actually handling things, and as good as, say, a squirrel in jumping from one tree to another, and things like that. So it's a long way to go before the interaction of robots with the real world is good. So I think it's going to come, and there are great values. And since I'm interested in space, of course, the main location where robots are going to be far better than humans is in space, because humans are ill-adapted to being in space, and it's very expensive and risky to send them there. And so my personal view is that the case for sending people into space, the practical case, is getting weaker all the time as the robots get better. And they can explore for us, and they can assemble structures in space under zero G, etc. And that'll be a very exciting development for robots.
And because you spoke about robots, I want to ask you a question about autonomous weapons. We have autonomous weapons, defensive autonomous weapons. For example, in Israel, there is the Iron Dome, which is a sort of a defensive autonomous weapon. And then more recently, there was the issue of super swarm drones. Swarm drones, so lots of drones that maybe you can give them a task, they go and attack an objective, and it's going to be very difficult to defend from those things. Do you think this should be classified as weapons of mass destruction?
Well, one should certainly try and inhibit their development, just like we try to inhibit the development of biological weapons and chemical weapons. In the same way, it's going to be very dangerous if we do have robots which fight each other and use facial recognition to identify an individual and then kill them. This is the kind of thing which people talk about. And I think we need to do all we can to slow down those developments, just as we've tried to with chemical and biological weapons.
Yeah, and then you also mentioned another thing. You said when things are possible, people will do them. And you make an example of taxes and drugs. You say those things are illegal, but people do them anyways. And it's, how can you find them out if you don't know where things are, right?
Well, indeed. And that's why I'm pessimistic. And I think if you ask me what's my biggest worry in the next 20 years, it is pandemics which are engineered artificially. As I mentioned in my book, I think about 9 years ago, two groups of scientists showed they could make the influenza virus more virulent and more transmissible by engineering it, and that they will be able to do the same thing for the coronavirus, and they'll be able to synthesize the smallpox virus and all that. Obviously, there will be regulations against all these things, internationally agreed, and academies of different countries are already discussing these. But the point I made, and the reason I'm scared, is just what you say, that we can't enforce these laws globally any more than the tax laws or the drug laws. And that's because they don't require large special purpose facilities like making an atom bomb does. We have the International Atomic Energy Agency, which can, with reasonable success, monitor what countries are doing in the nuclear arena. It's very hard for them to get away. I mean, Israel's made a pretty good job of it, but it's pretty hard for countries to actually get away with too much. But in the context of biological weapons, the technology is present in many university labs, many industrial labs, it's dual use, etc. And we can't monitor all those labs all the time. And I think one of the problems is that there's going to be a growing tension between three things we want to preserve: privacy, security, and freedom. Because even if a few people are mavericks and try to build a weapon, that's too many. And so I think we've got to accept that we have to be more sort of surveillance. And the way the balance is struck between those three things will be different in different countries. I guess the Chinese will be happier to give up their privacy in order to have security. The Americans at the other extreme may be reluctant, and they'll have to accept greater insecurity. But I think that's a problem simply because we can't monitor everyone all the time.
Maybe the Chinese Communist Party would be happy to give up freedom, maybe not the Chinese people. It's a different thing, I think. Probably the Chinese people would want to have more freedom, but the Chinese Communist Party is not going to give them freedom.
Well, I don't know. I think they owe a lot to the Communist Party. Yeah.
Now, going back to the threats from super AI and this kind of weapons, what do you think about the concept of mutual assured destruction, the MAD concept, which we had during the Cold War? Is that effective? Is it more effective than regulations?
I think it's very dangerous because, going back to what we were saying earlier, there can be false alarms, misunderstandings, etc. And if you think back to the Cold War, I'm old enough to have been alive during much of the Cold War. And if we read what was said about the Cold War by people who were in power at that time, the memos of Kennedy and McNamara and people like that, it's fairly clear that they thought the risks were rather high. In fact, at the time of the Cuba crisis in 1962, Kennedy said the threat of a nuclear exchange was between 1 in 3 and evens. And McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense of America at that time, he said they were lucky rather than wise to survive the Cuba crisis. And of course, there's been documentation subsequently of various false alarms where this could be triggered. And so I think if we look back at the Cold War, we can say it worked. There was no exchange and a mutually assured destruction did work, because the game theory suggests that if people are rational and well-informed, then they might avoid that. But I think, and I say in my book, that it was an unwise policy, because if the chance was 1 in 3 or even 1 in 6, it's like playing a Russian roulette with 1 or 2 bullets in the cylinder. And you don't do that unless the stakes are very high, or unless you value your life very low. And that's the situation we were placed under. And I myself, if I'd been asked, I would not have risked a 1 in 3 or even a 1 in 6 chance of the destruction of the fabric of European civilization, even if the alternative was a certain takeover by Russia of Western Europe.
Better red than dead, which is what Bertrand Russell said.
Indeed, yes. And he was quite right. And of course, we were lucky. But of course, that's like the guy who plays Russian roulette. He may be lucky, but that doesn't mean it was a sensible gamble.
And then in the US, after a few years, someone said better dead than red.
That's right. Yes. Okay. And so I don't have much sympathy with them.
So we spoke about Cold War. And so when there was the Cold War, it was mainly the West against the East, or so, say, sort of capitalist against the communists. But the good thing there was that we were sort of independent. We could make our goods in our countries, in the UK, Europe, US. But now the situation is different. Now, if we say there is a Cold War between, let's say, US and China, these two countries are strongly interdependent. So in case there is a war, then there will be a huge disruption in the supply chains, which is what happened with the pandemic. So what do you think would be the solution? Well, of course, the solution would be peace. But that's not always the thing that happens. But do you think we should reduce globalization and go more towards produce locally and where things are needed?
Well, I mean, I think globalization on the whole is probably good. Because it's an extra disincentive to having some sort of serious conflict. But on the other hand, I think what we've learnt is that there is another trade-off, which is the one between efficiency and resilience. And we've seen examples of that, in that if you have a factory and you depend on parts coming from supply chains all over the world, and if there's a supply chain that leads to somewhere in the Far East, and if one link in that chain is broken, then that stops your production, then of course you're vulnerable. And I think people have learnt that it's probably worth the extra cost and, in a sense, the inefficiency of having multiple supply chains and keeping an inventory in stock rather than depending on just-in-time delivery, in order to be more resilient if there is some unexpected crisis. So I think that's certainly a lesson that we're going to learn from this pandemic, that efficiency is not the only thing that matters. And to take a quite different example, Germany had a policy of keeping a larger fraction of its hospital intensive care beds empty all the time, except for a crisis, and 20%, so they could cope with the crisis better than we could, where we prized ourselves on 95% occupancy, which is, in a sense, more efficient, but it doesn't give you the headroom if there is a crisis. So that's another example where it's worth accepting inefficiency in order to be more resilient when there is a crisis.
Yeah, and then, of course, I mean, trying to reduce globalization will also help with other things like pollution, because, I mean, with these huge supply chains that go far, like to China and so on, I mean, they have a huge carbon footprint. Also, there is the issue of labor rights there and, you know, plenty of issues there.
Yes, well, I'm not sure I agree with you in wanting to reduce globalization. I think one thing which I do think very strongly is we need to do something to help Africa, because Africa is lagging behind in terms of its economic development, and it's also the area of the world where population is still growing fastest. Sub-Saharan Africa hasn't been through the demographic transition towards lower birth rate, and so the population is growing fast, and there's a risk that Africa will be trapped in poverty, partly because they can't develop the way the East Asian countries did, which was by cheap manufacturing, undercutting the wage levels in Europe and North America, because robots are now doing that. We have what's called reshoring of manufacturing in rich countries because it doesn't need so much labor. So that's a ladder's been kicked away from African countries. And so it's not so obvious how they are going to develop. The other point is that the one thing they do have is information and the ability to travel. They know via mobile phones what they're missing. They know the injustice of their fate. And if this huge inequality persists between the lifestyle of the average African and our lifestyles, then this is going to be a recipe for embitterment, mass migration and conflict. And so I think there's a very strong motive for the northern countries, especially those in Europe, to have a sort of mega Marshall Plan in order to ensure that Africa doesn't fall further behind. And this is not just altruistic reasons, it's to make a safer and more stable world.
Yeah, I mean, but the problem is that I think colonialism never ended in Africa, right? I mean, we never stopped exploiting Africa in a way or another one. In the past, we used to send soldiers. Now, maybe we pay some corrupt politician to get some resources from those places. And
I think there are positive as well as negative in the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative.
And also, there are the wars that we started in North Africa, for example, that created all sorts of problems, for example, in Libya.
Indeed. Yes. I mean, I think, you know, the West and especially the Americans have a great deal to answer for.
One thing I wanted to ask is that, so basically you kind of predicted the pandemic in this book. You said that you actually did a bet with Mr. Pinker. That was $1,000. And did you win that? Or?
Well, it's interesting because I had the bet and that there would be a pandemic with a million casualties. And of course, the actual COVID-19 had been far worse than that. I may lose the bet because I said in my bet that I thought the pandemic would be not a natural one, but an engineered one. And although, of course, some people think that the virus leaked out of the lab in Wuhan, I don't think most people believe that. And so technically, I'm going to lose my bet with Stephen. On the other hand, I think he has learned the lesson that we can't be so optimistic about the future, because something far worse than he envisaged has actually happened naturally.
Yeah, I mean, the investigation is going to be complicated there, but do you think it really matters? Or do you think it's important to investigate on what really happened there, if it came from animals or if it came from a lab or if it came... Do you think it's relevant at all? Or?
Well, I certainly think it's important. I mean, the most likely thing is it did come from animals. If that's the case, then it's hugely important to minimise the sort of situations in those markets of live animals, etc. Because most of the experts think that as the world's getting more crowded, there's going to be more interaction between animals and humans, and that the risk of the transfer of viruses between species is going to grow. So I think it's very, very important to do all we can to minimise that sort of transfer, because most of the experts think that if we don't, then the probability of these pandemics is going to get higher and higher. And of course, let's not forget that they could be far worse than the present one.
And I guess there, I mean, if it came from a wet market, then the solution is simply more hygiene. Just avoid those bad conditions, stacking the animals on top of each other, if it came from a wet market.
Yes, or maybe something more drastic. Yeah. Hmm.
Or close them down. And you spoke about, before you spoke about a short-term perspective from politicians and so on, also probably from the media. And one thing I want to discuss is that, I mean, I was looking at the statistics of deaths worldwide. And so from the pandemic, we had, that at least that's the reported one, about 1.8 million people died with the COVID. But then there were also 1 million suicides, and there were 8 million deaths due to cancer. So it seems that, why do you think we don't give enough attention to long-term problems like cancer and so on? Because, I mean, this is a far bigger problem, I think.
Well, I mean, I disagree. I think there's a huge amount of research on trying to deal with cancer. It's a very intractable problem. They haven't made tremendous progress. And it's part of which people are living longer for other reasons. And I would actually say if we think of the balance of medical research, there's not enough being done on tropical diseases of the poor. And because the number of children who die from infectious diseases in Africa, I don't know what the numbers are, but that's in millions per year. And so I think we certainly need to deal with all these diseases, including cancer, but I think they are much more difficult to deal with. And I think the effort of medical research is pretty strongly focused on cancer, isn't it, at the moment?
Okay, yeah. And then there is the problem of suicides, which is another problem. The suicides are increasing, especially now with all the psychological problems that this pandemic has created.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, I think that's not that's fully understandable, because, of course, the pandemic has not hugely affected people who can work from home, etc. But those who are forced to go out and risk dangers, and who are living in cramped apartments, they've had a really, really bad time. And if they've got children, it's understandable. And this is just an example of how mental health and greater equality are two things we don't prioritize enough. And we need, in particular, to reduce inequalities. In fact, one of the lessons which I hope will be learned from the pandemic is that the people who really matter in a crisis are delivery drivers, health workers, and people like that. And they are the people whose jobs are insecure, who get low status, and they ought to be raised. So I think the inequalities, which are far too great within countries as well as between countries, need to be reduced. And I worry that in this country we are not moving fast enough in that direction. And of course, America is even worse. And I think we should realize that we in this country can learn far more from Scandinavian countries than we can from the United States in terms of a better social system, because for mental health, people have to feel secure and valued. And that is not happening in this country or in America, but it's happening more in the Scandinavian countries. And when there are sort of attempts to measure or on the basis of opinion polls, general happiness and contentment, then I think Denmark comes out as number one. And Britain and America are much lower, but the Scandinavian countries come out top. And that's because they have public services, they accept high tax rates to provide a good welfare state, high quality services for everyone, and avoid excessive inequalities. So that's the way we need to go.
And do you think we should have a universal basic income?
Something in effect like that. I mean, I think everyone who can work should have to work. But I think what we should have is very large numbers of dignified, well-paid jobs paid for by the public sector, for instance, carers in old people's homes, assistance for teachers and things like that. The people are going to be put out of work by AI in the short term are people who work in Amazon warehouses, in call centres, etc., which are fairly mind-numbing jobs anyway. But what's needed is that the companies that own those robots should be heavily taxed so that the government can fund large numbers of properly paid jobs for carers, gardeners in public parks, teachers' assistants, the kind of jobs where being human is important and where there's a huge undersupply at the moment. So that's the kind of thing that needs to happen. And so this would not be giving people an automatic wage, but it would be giving people the opportunity of jobs which are socially beneficial and satisfying, and also would be producing a sort of welfare state so that the everyone was kept above a much higher level than the rather vestigial welfare state does at the moment. So it just means a higher taxation. So the mantra of low tax economies is, in my view, a very damaging one. We should accept that we need higher taxation.
And you said that the wages of so-called essential workers should increase.
Yes.
But also during the pandemic, we had a huge problem, which is the sort of destruction of small businesses in favor of a big corporation like Amazon, for example.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. And of course, what's outrageous is the very big corporations, because they're multinational, they famously don't pay anything like their fair share of taxes. And so it's the tax from them which could make a huge difference in helping small businesses, but also in producing enough jobs to meet the need in care homes and in schools.
So I wanted to go back a little bit about policies and prevention and all these things. What do you think we could have done in order to avoid this pandemic?
It's not clear. I mean, it would have been worth spending a lot of money if we could, because the pandemic is going to, over the next few years, have a total cost for the world, which people have estimated at least $20 trillion. And even if you think the probability was only once per 50 years, that means that if you work out the insurance premium by multiplying probability by impact, it would have been worth spending several hundred billion dollars in order to reduce it or eliminate it. And that wasn't done, and that's a lesson we've learned. I suppose what we could have done is been better prepared to produce vaccines for the coronavirus, as we had done, incidentally, for influenza virus. The British had stocked up on vaccines for a flu pandemic, but not for this kind. And they also hadn't taken account that this kind of pandemic required lots of protective clothing for medical staff, and it might be hard to develop a vaccine. So things like that. But also, of course, if you think of what the World Health Organization could do, if one could have a more effective monitoring program, so that, again, I say this in my book, so that a Vietnamese farmer immediately notices and reports any strange disease in his flock, etc. There are ways of monitoring these newly emergent things to catch them before they spread to humans or spread very far, then that would be better. And it would clearly be worth having a far more scaled up program to do that sort of thing. I mean, these are fairly sort of obvious suggestions, but it's clear that if you think of the costs of a pandemic, it's worth spending a lot more in trying to mitigate it or prevent it. And given that pandemics often start in remote places, on farms, etc., then having a more efficient way of ensuring that they are stopped near the source, as it were, before they spread, would clearly be good value. So that's just one example.
So basically, essentially, you're suggesting more power transfer from countries to sort of global organizations And at page 32, you wrote that we need to ask whether nations need to give more sovereignty to new organizations like United Nations, International Atomic Energy Agency, World Health Organization. But one of the reasons why, at least here, people voted for Brexit was sovereignty and disagreement with policies developed by unelected eurocrats and technocrats. So people wanted to take back sovereignty.
Well, I mean, let me say, I mean, as someone who is very strongly against Brexit and think it's a major mistake, which was achieved by a very dishonest campaign by Johnson and his colleagues, which people will regret in the next few years, I strongly disagree. Because do you think Mr. President Macron is worried about losing sovereignty? Because he's in the EU? Certainly not. And are we gaining sovereignty? We're just losing authority. We've been more marginalised. And just to take one example, we say that we are sovereign, our power stations are being built by French and Chinese organisations. Our trains, they may be privatised, but they're owned by partly owned by foreign governments. Our car factories are mainly owned by Japanese or German companies. So it's complete nonsense to say that we are an economically independent nation. We are, in many of our facilities, foreign-owned, and this need not be a bad thing necessarily, but it just means it's absurd to try and be a little England again.
For scientific research, it's really bad.
Well, that's one, but there are more important things than that for the for the average public. And the latest opinion polls showed that I think a majority was now against Brexit. And of course, when they realise what it actually involves in the next 6 months, I predict that more and more people will regret that we ever went through with it. But going back to what we were saying earlier, it was a debate where the people who voted for Brexit were often the people who did not feel empowered. They felt left behind. They thought this was the consequence of being in the EU. In fact, it wasn't. It was a fault of the present government's austerity policies, which was weakening public services, etc. And similarly, in America, there was a feeling that workers had been left behind because, of course, there's even less of welfare states in America than here. So there's good reason why many people in our very inegalitarian society should have felt aggrieved. But they were entirely mistaken to believe that either Mr. Trump in the US or Mr. Johnson in this country was going to do anything to improve their lot. Because the mantra of the present government is low taxation, etc., and not to improve the welfare state. So I think it was a sort of con trick, and I just think that it will end up badly for the people who were taken in by the vote.
Of course, it's UK, US is a very different economy.
Yes, well, I mean, we got to realise just how different the US is from Europe. 70 million people voted for Trump even the second time, and even more than 70 million people want to carry guns. And this seems alien to Northern Europeans. And that's why I say we can learn more from the example of the Scandinavian countries than from America.
Yeah, the gun right is something that comes from the history of the United States, and there were reasons for that. But here we have a different past.
Indeed, and we're lucky for that, yes.
So do you think global governance is the best approach towards global risks? Or do you think each country can work out their deals with partners like separately without using a global organization? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think we've got to bear in mind the reality now is that there are global companies, the big internet companies and Amazon and all these, which in a sense they're providing a huge service, but they are not under the legislative control of any single country. And that is why, as we know, they pay far less of their profit in tax than a small business has to. And this is a plain injustice. And this certainly needs some sort of international regulation. People talk about the regulation of AI and the internet and all that. And we certainly need regulation because otherwise there's no way that regulation or control of these huge global conglomerates can be implemented. So I think that that's an example. And I think there may be other needs for organizations rather like the WHO. I mean, maybe if we have a deal for countries to cut carbon emissions for reasons of mitigating climate change, then there may need to be a separate organization rather like those to actually monitor progress and see if countries are actually implementing what they're pledging to do in cutting CO2 emissions. So that's an example. There could be a commission, which is international, for dealing with climate change and energy policy generally, because that's becoming more international. So and aviation, obviously, is international. So I think even though we may want more regionalism in some context to go to smaller scales, there are some areas which are consequences of the way technology has developed, which do need to have more international regulation than the current system allows.
How would you ensure that organizations like the WHO, or there are many organizations like that, do the interests of the citizens of the world rather than particular interests and the corporate interests and the specific country's interests? This is very difficult. This is going to be a very difficult thing.
Well, it's difficult, but I would have far more hope that they will be altruistic than that Amazon will be.
For sure, yeah. So the reason why I'm saying that is that because, I mean, if we consider what happened with the WHO, recently United States stopped funding the WHO, so now the WHO at the moment is mainly
quite disgraceful decision that was. Hmm.
It's mainly founded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. That those are the first ones in the list. It looks like the director has got strong links with China. So there is a huge influence of China in the WHO. Maybe there is less influence from other countries and so on.
Yes, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. Especially, you know, if you think of what China's done for the WHO compared to what Trump did for the WHO, the Americans don't have any high ground in that area. Although, as you say, Bill Gates' foundation has been a definite plus. Thank goodness there are some billionaires with his concern about these problems, especially Africa. And I've just been reading a book he's publishing next month on climate change and how to deal with it.
Okay. And another thing that the Americans pulled off from was the Paris Agreement for the carbon emissions. But if you look at the graphs and the statistics, I mean, the carbon emissions have been steadily going down for America and the United Kingdom, European Union, and so on. I mean, for the West in general, they've been going down since the beginning of 2000. So I think we've been doing a good job irrespective of who the president was. And so the problem then becomes, how do you make sure that countries like India and China don't pollute too much? How do you enforce that?
Yes. Well, first, I mean, I think we shouldn't be very smug because, of course, two things have happened in the last 30 years. Well, one is going from coal to gas. And the other is that a lot of our sort of emissions in this country have been transferred to China because they manufacture lots of stuff we buy. So you've got to allow for that sort of thing before you interpret these figures properly. I think we have a long way to go. And if we look at the figures, China is producing CO2 at about half the level per capita that we are. But of course, India is far, far lower. And one of the things that I think is very, very important is that India which needs to develop. India needs more energy per capita to develop. It needs a grid and not just smoky stoves burning wood and dung in people's homes. And so they need more. And the important thing is to arrange that they can leapfrog directly to clean energy without being forced to build more coal-fired power stations, because that's cheaper. And so, in my view, that's why it's very important for countries like ours to accelerate our research and development into clean energy in all its forms, and I would include nuclear in this, and also in the energy storage, batteries and smart grids and all these things, so that the cost comes down as technology advances, and India can then leapfrog to it, just like they've never had landline phones, they've leapfrogged directly to mobile phones. And so we should work with India, not neocolonialism, we should work with India to have an expanded research program so that they can expand their energy use, which they need to do clearly, for air conditioning, nothing else, without producing more CO2. Because if you look at the projections, then it's true that we could reduce our per capita emissions still more by energy efficiency in various ways. But India is probably going to need to increase its energy consumption by quite a big factor if they're to all develop middle-class lives, as it were, and have air conditioning. And so what the more important thing is how those countries get their energy 20 years from now. And we've got to do all we can to ensure that they can get that energy in carbon-free ways.
We spoke about the sort of duality between liberty and safety, because some people value safety more than freedom, and other people value freedom more than safety. And we spoke about better red than dead, or better dead than red. So do you think adjusting and controlling freedom and safety should be a government prerogative? Or do you think government should give the citizens the option to choose what they prefer, whether they prefer freedom or whether they prefer safety?
Well, it's not such a stark trade-off as you imply, but I think most people would say that the prime objective of government is to keep its citizens safe. And this obviously involves some constraints on the more aggressive among the citizens. So I think everyone agrees that to ensure the rule of law and safety of the public is the prime goal of civilization, of any nation government.
Okay. And have you had a look at the great Barrington Declaration on the concept of focused protection?
Yes, I have.
What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, it was supported by some of the usual suspects, but by very few of the genuine experts. So I give very little weight to it. And I think we've seen through this pandemic that the people who said it was not serious have been proved completely wrong, and indeed their interventions have been damaging. And I think the Great Barrington Declaration was another example of that.
Hmm. And so basically what the declaration says is that we should protect people at their risk, but then open the economy, because otherwise it's going to be a disaster.
Well, that's what they said, but I mean, it's been endless debate, which I think suggests that that's not feasible, because children can carry the disease back to their grandparents and all that. So all kinds of reasons. That was a very unhelpful initiative. And it came from some American think tank, which had been against dealing with climate change in the same way. So there's these people who object to any kind of regulation. And you should look at the provenance of that particular document before you take it too seriously.
We've got so many different vaccines now, and we've got different types of vaccines. What do you think about the way the vaccine campaign has been done?
Well, I mean, I think, so far as I can tell, it's done better than some people suspected, because it wasn't clear that a vaccine could be developed quickly, because, for instance, AIDS is a 40-year-old disease and there's still no proper vaccine for that. So some people were saying that it'd be very difficult to have any kind of vaccine for this. So to that extent, I think things have gone better than people expected, and that's gone well. I think the things that went badly, certainly in this country, it was the test and trace, which was inefficient compared to what happened in the countries of Southeast Asia. Taiwan was the biggest success in this, but we did very badly. Partly because it was contracted out to a private sector company without the right expertise or commitment. But we did very badly, and I think the US also did badly. So I think the vaccine program has turned out to have achieved successes rather quicker than some people suspected. And so that's been a bit of good news, I think.
Yeah, and the thing is that there are different types of vaccines. There are the more traditional ones that are based on deactivated viruses, but then there are also the new ones, which are the ones based on mRNA. The thing is that there are some risks with the mRNA vaccines, and I don't know if these are being discussed enough. So that's why I was asking that question.
Well, I mean, they're clearly being discussed a huge amount, and you're quite right that they're very different, and some may work better for mutation than others. We don't know. And all I can say is that I think it's good that we do have this variety and have huge expertise around the world in developing them. So I think that's been good news. But obviously, it's very, very complicated science, and they're learning all the time.
And it's not as easy as physics. In physics, we deal with the easier samples.
Well, indeed. I mean, I always make the point that physics is an easy science compared to anything involving biology. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so do you think there is any risk that the policies that are being implemented now in terms of lockdowns will persist in the next maybe 20 years? I mean, we've seen something. I'm drawing a parallel with the war on terror, because, that was drawn by Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum. He spoke about the parallels between COVID and 9/11. And there are many parallels. I mean, with 9/11, we've seen intensification of monitoring with cameras everywhere and all these restrictions. Do you think there is any risk that the lockdowns will continue in the future?
Well, I mean, I think there is, but of course you're right in saying it had been proportionate. I mean, maybe some of the concerns involved in current airport security, for instance, may be excessive, and CCTV cameras. I think most people now welcome those, but I think obviously it's got to be a balance. But I think we have to be prepared that there could be something even worse than COVID, and we should be prepared for that.
So the last thing I wanted to discuss with you is future. So you spoke a lot about post-humanism and transhumanism. Would you like to explain what's this concept of transhumanism?
Well, I mean, it's really some ideas which are very widely known, which is that within 50 years, it may be possible to produce sort of designer babies, as it were, because we know that you can already do genetic modification that reduces risk to some single gene disease like Huntington's. But it may be possible 50 years from now, using AI to analyze large samples, to see which combination of genes optimizes certain desirable characteristics in humans, and then to synthesize a genome with those. And so it may be possible by the end of a century to have sort of designed humans, etc. Now, the question is this something which on ethical grounds we should try to regulate against or not? And there's a debate there. Some people like this idea. I have two thoughts on this. One is that it would lead to a more fundamental kind of inequality that we now have if only a few people could afford this and could enhance themselves in this fundamental way. And so I would like to see it strongly regulated on Earth. But on the other hand, I think by the end of the century, there'll be a few people living on Mars. Mr. Elon Musk et al. Maybe on Mars. And I think they're the people who should be allowed to do this if they want, because they are adapting to a hostile environment. We're pretty well adapted to living on the Earth, but they're badly adapted to living on Mars. And so I think we should cheer them on in using all these techniques of genetic modification and cyborg to adapt themselves or their progeny to living in these hostile environments. Good luck to them. But I feel that we should try to restrain these technologies here on Earth.
Because then there is the risk that you might create two sort of races, a superior race and an inferior race. And then what's going to happen? They're going to put in that zoo the inferior race or something.
Well, that's right. So that's why I'm against this being allowed here on Earth.
What's your view on the sort of interfacing between humans and machines? Because you mentioned Elon Musk.
Well, I mean, of course, we do interface with our mobile phones in a way, so we're doing that. And I know some people like him are talking about the idea of sort of plugging in additional memories and things like that, you know, linking to our brains. And maybe this could be done one day. I don't know. It's possible. But I don't go along with the idea that we can download our brains completely.
As Ray Kurzweil said.
Right, yes, because it's not clear in what sense that would still be you. Which, I mean, I think we feel that our bodies are essential to being us. And so if you can download your brain into some machine, it may have some features of your brain, maybe some memories, and you could, if you could download one, you could make lots of duplicates of it. Which one would be you?
And then they're going to fight against each other. What's going to be?
Well, that's right. Yeah. So it's not clear what possibilities there are and whether that'll stay science fiction. I rather hope it will. But of course, it is interesting that the problem of personal identity is something which has been discussed by philosophers for generations, you know, what is the essence of you? But it could be that some of those issues will become part of practical ethics, not just academic philosophy, if any of these ideas become feasible.
Yeah. Just one thing I wanted to point out that you said, oh, we already interface with the mobile phones. But now think about, okay, mobile phones, they're basically tracking you. They check what you do or what are your preferences, and they use that for commercial purposes. They sell your data. But now think about if you are connected with the... If the thing is connected to your brain, they might read your thoughts or maybe plant ideas into your mind and make you buy things that then transform you into a zombie or something like that.
Yes, that's why I don't want that. Mm. Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Leave it to people on Mars to do that.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. Last question. What's your next prediction?
I worry that we are going to have a rather bumpy ride through the coming decades. I think because governing society is going to become harder, and that's partly because inequalities are far too great, and people have very good reason for feeling embittered and angry about the system they're living under. That's one. And also, the point which, in fact, I made in my first book, 2003, is that we are in a world where a few people, if they have the motive, can produce a catastrophe which could cascade globally. This is something which is only possible because of cyber, the internet, and biotech. And so this is a challenge to governance, which has never been so severe until this century. And so the question is, to what extent can governments cope and minimize these risks, which will cause global catastrophes and social breakdown? I think they're going to be a big challenge, so I just hope for the best.
Okay, Professor Martin Rees, thank you very much for doing this, and have a great day.
Okay, same to you.
Thank you for listening to this conversation with Professor Martin Rees. If you enjoyed it, please leave a comment below, like, subscribe, turn on the notification bell, and support this channel on Patreon. This podcast is also available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. You can find the links in the description below. Thanks for watching.